theoretical physics, they've been awarded very frequently for this other type of thing, which is some sort of quick and dirty cleverness, which is where I'm talking about theoretical physics, but it's a, anyway, it's this other, in my opinion, often neglected branch of theoretical physics that maybe, yeah. But anyway, so my point is that there's no better example of that than what we're getting to here, which is hopefully at the end of the lecture give a quick and dirty demonstration imagine we are Gamov in the 1940s and realizing that actually helium was not created in stars, it was created in the Big Bang, which now is our best, earliest experimental, you know, demonstration that we understand what's going on in the early universe. So anyway, the punchline today, hopefully, if we get to it, is going to be somehow you should stand back and think about how, you know, take a moment to appreciate how totally awesome it is. So to start out, I emailed my notes to Tibra, but I forgot to attach them to the email. So Tibra got an empty email, which is why you don't have anything on there. So I'll email them to him again after the class. Sorry about that. So I'm going to continue with explaining the rudiments of sort of thermodynamics and statistical mechanics in expanding spacetimes. And so the basic thing to get across, okay, so the only thing we really had a chance to cover last time was just the simple fact that if any quantity is conserved, then the density of that quantity scales as a to the minus 3 as the universe expands. And so we said, in particular, if the number of particles, total number of particles is conserved, if particles aren't being created or annihilated, then their number density scales as a to the minus 3. And so their energy density scales as a to the minus 3 times however their energy scales. And we argued that since E is equal to E squared is equal to P squared plus M squared, then when the particle is relativistic, so we can ignore its mass, E scales as 1 over P, because one of the essential things we've derived so far in the course is that P scales as 1 over A. I think I just said that wrong. Oh, and I'm going to try to be more linear on the board. But, okay, so far I am being linear, but just in the wrong direction. So what I meant to say is, since P always scales as 1 over A, for a relativistic particle, we can cover up the m squared term here. So E scales as 1 over A. So for a relativistic particle, rho scales as a to the minus 4. Whereas for a non-relativistic particle, we can cover up this term, and E scales as a to the 0. And then we said, comparing that with our previous formula for how rho scales with A, that it scales as a to the minus 3, 1 plus w, we can see that relativistic particles correspond to w equals 1 third. Non-relativistic particles correspond to w equals 0. Okay. So much for that. Now, yeah?
So the fact that for relativistic particles, we can think of them as photons, right?
Well, photons would be an example. Massless particles are always relativistic, but also...
The wavelength is also changing.
Right.
And this takes into account that as well?
Yep. So another way to say this is that suppose you have a box of photons. As the universe expands, the number density in the box goes down, but also the wavelength of each, so that the number density goes down is 1 upon a cubed. But then, in addition, the energy density would be h bar omega times the number density. And omega goes down as 1 upon a as the universe expands. So the whole thing goes down as 1 upon... So rho goes down as 1 upon a to the 4th. Okay. This side of the board is out until I finish this side of the board. It's like you have to eat your dinner before you have your dessert or something like that. So I... And when I was in graduate school, I got taught a... I just want to make myself feel better by the following story. I took my introductory string theory class from Ed Witten, who you've probably heard of, and he's Anyway, so his teaching style was he writes incredibly fast. Okay, he would fill up the blackboard in no time, breaking chalk like crazy along the way, and then he would never erase it, and instead he would just continue to just smudge out little patches about this big and write something else in them at random points on the board. And so the board just became this tapestry. So I do feel like I'm better than that, but also I wanna say, you know, somehow it doesn't another thing while I'm on this subject that I have to mention is he also had this thing where he would gesture very fast with his hands holding an eraser. And so right before this class, it was always scheduled on the day that the maintenance people had just cleaned that room. And whenever they cleaned the room, they stacked up the chalk neatly, and then they stacked up a big pile of erasers. And he would gesture, and frequently he was sort of loosely holding the eraser in one hand and the chalk in the other hand, and he would just eject an eraser or a piece of chalk, and it would like hit the wall with like a slam, or it would hit the back wall with a slam. He was, you know, talking vigorously. But the main thing is, and then sometimes he would just throw it at his feet. Okay, so he would just have an eraser at his feet. But he was sort of lost in thought, typically, and so he wouldn't really react to it. He would just turn around and take another eraser off of the stack and just continue. Anyway, so So, another important thing is to understand when particles are in thermal equilibrium. When some fraction of the matter is in thermal equilibrium, how does it evolve? So you probably learned in a statistical mechanics class once upon a time about the phase space distribution function. So phase space, you know, is this space that's parameterized by the x coordinates and the p coordinates. So in three dimensions, in our three dimensional space, our phase space would have six dimensions. And if I look at a little phase space volume here, d cubed x, d cubed p, if the expected number of particles in that little phase space volume, the expected number of particles in that phase space volume is of the ith species of particle, is f sub I, the species evaluated at the position x and p and time t, then this thing is called the distribution function, the phase space distribution function. It's basically the density of particles in phase space. Okay? And so, you know, if that's the density of particle in phase space, then the density of particles in real space is obtained by just integrating over all the different momenta that a particle can have at a given point in real space. So the number density as a function of x and t in real space, I can obtain by just integrating over all the possible momenta at that position, the phase space distribution function. And then the energy density in real space you know, what I want to know is not just count up how many particles there are, but how many particles there are weighted by their energy. So, you know, I would just do this integral instead, times e, where e might be a function of p, or it could be a function of x and t also in general, although in our case it won't be usually. Okay, so that's for a general phase space distribution function. But if you have a complicated system and you let it interact with itself and you have no idea what it's up to, but you let it take its course, then for generic systems, what they do is they let their phase space distribution evolve until it reaches the thermal equilibrium state. With overwhelming probability, it reaches the phase space distribution function evolves to a particular form, the thermal form, which corresponds to the state of maximum entropy. And so a key result of quantum statistical mechanics is the distribution function for an ideal gas of bosons or fermions. Okay, and so you probably remember this guy, and it's certainly worth remembering this guy. So that result is, if I have an ideal gas of bosons or fermions, then the expected, so if I take a little volume of size h cubed, so h is Planck's constant, so h cubed is 2 pi h bar cubed, and I ask, in that little Planck size volume, so by the way, I should say, you know, h bar has units of angular momentum, right? Like the angular momentum is quantized in units of h bar. And so that has units of x times p. So this is the right units. If I have three x's and three p's, that has units, same units as h bar cubed. So anyway, so the result is, if I look at a little box of size 2 pi h bar cubed and ask what is the expected number of particles in that box, it's given by this famous formula that if the gas of particles is in thermal equilibrium, with the ice species at chemical potential mu sub I and thermal equilibrium at temperature T, then okay, that says 1 over exponential E minus mu I over KT minus plus 1, where the minus sign corresponds to bosons, and then this is called the Bose-Einstein distribution function, and the plus sign corresponds to fermions, and that would be called the Fermi-Dirac distribution function. So from now on, I'm going to set KB equal to 1. So that just means normally you're used to maybe quoting energy in, let's say, in this class we've often been quoting energies in units of electron volts or giga electron volts or mega electron volts, and that's what we'll be using later in this class, and it's kind of a standard particle physics-y way of talking about energy units. And so setting KB equal to 1 just means that we're not going to quote temperature in joules or whatever, we're going to quote it also in KeV or MeV. And so if you have a gas of photons at temperature 1 KeV, that means the typical energy of the photons in that gas is 1 KeV, for example. Okay, so that's the last KB I will write. So just like H bar and C, we set equal to 1, we're going to get rid of KB. Okay, so if I plug, so in other words, that's how many per this volume. So let me also set my H bar equal to 1. And so that means the distribution function is, you know, if you think about it, is the distribution function is 1 over, the distribution function defined this way is 1 over 2 pi cubed times this. So in thermal equilibrium, that means that this thing will become, so I plug in 1 over 2 pi cubed times this here and here, and then Since this only depends, since the integrand here only depends on the magnitude of P, magnitude of the spatial momentum, I can just go ahead and change my integration variable. I can, you know, it's, in other words, it's spherically symmetric with respect to P, the integrand is. So all of these d cubed P's become 4 pi P squared dp, where p is just the magnitude of the vector p. And then I can change, and then it's convenient to change integration variables from this p to this e. In which case, and so these are formulae that are in the notes, but it's actually one of the problems on the homework will be to just derive some of these formulae, because I it's worth going through once, but I don't want to do it in class. I know I'm breaking the first rule of this lecture, but so if you do that, I just want to have these formulae handy. So in thermal equilibrium, this, yep.
What's the interpretation of chemical potential in that case?
So that's a good question. I'm actually going to talk about that in a future lecture. But so if I can put off the full answer to that now, it's associated with if there are conserved quantities. So for example, there's two things to say. One is that we'll see that if some reaction like P plus E minus is in chemical equilibrium, is in rapidly going back and forth between proton and electron and neutron and electron neutrino, then for consistency it has to be the case. You wouldn't be able to make this statement self-consistent if you didn't have this extra constant available to you. For consistency, you can show that that in that circumstance, the chemical potentials have to be related by a simple formula like this. But physically, there's no conserved quantum number associated with the photon, for example. So the photon has no chemical potential. But the proton, for example, carries a conserved, at least a very well, very, as far as we have ever observationally been able to see, a conserved quantum number called baryon number. And so it does carry a chemical potential, a chemical potential that prevents it. Heuristically, thermal equilibrium, it wants to achieve the maximum state. It wants to do whatever complicated process is necessary to achieve the maximum entropy state of the system. But if there are some conserved quantities, some things that where maybe I could raise the entropy by changing the baryon number, but too bad, you're not allowed to do that. The baryon number is conserved. It's a rule of nature. You're not allowed to change the baryon number. So this chemical potential is the extra potential that keeps you away from what otherwise would have been a higher energy state if you would have been able to a higher entropy state if you had been able to violate that conservation law. So as I say, let me beyond that, let me come back to it in a future lecture. So these formulae become this guy becomes exactly the same thing, except everything is the same, except whereas this has an e to the 1 in the numerator, this guy has an e squared in the numerator. Okay. And then the thing that I ask you to show, a result that we'll be using, but that I'm just gonna let you guys derive once on the problem set is, it's good to look at what this equation becomes in various limits. So the first limit I want to look at is where the particle is relativistic, meaning that the temperature is much greater than the mass. So E in these formulae is again given by this expression. p squared plus mi squared. And so in the limit that the temperature is much greater than the mass of the particle, so you can basically set the mass of the particle to zero in all formulae. So for example here. And non-degenerate. So the temperature is much greater than the chemical potential. So you can set the chemical potential. The chemical potential becomes negligible in all of these formulae, and you can set it to zero. So in that case, you find that this becomes, for fermions, it becomes zeta of 3, the Riemann zeta function evaluated at 3, which is just some number. It's like 2 point something. I don't remember exactly what the number is. It's not crucial for us. Over pi squared t cubed. That's the answer for bosons. If we redid it for fermions, we would just find an overall factor of 3/4 here. So this is all times 1 for bosons and 3/4 for fermions. And then this guy evaluates to pi squared over 30 t to the fourth, and then times 1 for bosons, or 7/8 for fermions. And so these various numerical factors are not important to remember. These 3/4 and 7/8 and the pi squared and the zeta of 3. I mean, the key point here is just that in the relativistic limit, up to order 1 factors, the number density of each species in thermal equilibrium at temperature T is just its temperature cubed, whereas the radiation density contributed by that species is just an order 1 factor times temperature to the fourth. And so if you have G star different species, then the number density is basically just G star times T cubed, and the energy density is G star times T to the fourth. So by different species, I mean, for example, you know, at some point in the early universe, you might have electrons. The only particles hanging around still might be electrons, positrons, three neutrinos, three antineutrinos, a photon, and so let's say those might be the only particles that are still relativistic and in thermal equilibrium at some moment. And so, you know, each of these is a different species, and in fact, some of these guys, so this guy has two spins, two different, that guy can have helicity plus or helicity minus, so that's two. The neutrinos cannot, at least not the normal neutrinos, not the, yeah. So actually the neutrinos can, because you have right nanoneutrinos too. So the point is that this is what I mean by counting species. Each of these different types of particles is a different species, and then I also have to, so every particle, every antiparticle is a different species, and then I also have to count up the number of spin states per particle, right? All of the different possible excitations that are available for a given, physically distinct excitations that are available for a given momentum, three momentum p vector. Okay. And so these answers you could have guessed right at the beginning by dimensional analysis. So in units where h bar is equal to c is equal to 1 and is equal to k Boltzmann. So temperature has units of energy, So does mass. So does momentum. And whereas length, so these all have units of energy, whereas length and time have units of energy to the minus one. People are familiar with these facts. So the number density, that's the number per unit volume. Number is just a number divided by volume. So that has units of 1 over length cubed. So the answer has to have units of energy cubed. The only energy scale in the problem, in the relativistic limit, I've set all of the other energy scales are based, all of the other things with units of energy have been set to 0. They're negligible. The only energy scale I have left to play with is T, and so I should expect that this answer will end up being an order 1 factor times T cubed. And similarly, energy density, that's energy per volume, so that's energy times length to the minus 3, energy to the 4th. So I should expect this to be an order 1 factor times T to the 4th. So without ever rederiving this, you'll always remember to just write down that the number density of a relativistic species goes down like T cubed, and the energy density is roughly T to the 4th. And for estimating many things about the universe, those are useful things to know. So then, the one other thing. So then, on the problem set, you'll also derive the non-relativistic limit, where M is greater, not necessarily much greater than mu I. So M I is greater than mu I, but then T is much less than M I. Then, in that limit, these formulae become instead, the number density, the important thing to say about it, so it becomes MI T over 2 pi to the 3 halves exponential mu I minus MI over T. So that's the number density in the non-relativistic limit, and the energy density just becomes the mass times the number density. So this is clear, right? When a particle becomes very non-relativistic, so its energy is basically just equal to its mass, then the energy density should just be equal to the mass times the number density, right? This is the intuitive thing you would expect. The only important thing to say about this, but it's very important, is that a particle in thermal equilibrium, if it's in thermal equilibrium at a temperature that is below its mass, then it is exponentially scarce, right? This is a negative number in the numerator, and when the denominator becomes much less than it, you have e to minus a large negative number, which is small. So with just these formulae, you can get a first glance at what goes on in the early universe. You can get sort of the general picture. And that is, okay, so in the early universe, we argued that radiation dominated at early time. Yeah. Well, so not... So far we've been working in an FRW spacetime that is homogeneous. Every quantity is the same everywhere in space, and they only vary in time. So eventually they will. A system that has achieved perfect thermal equilibrium will have the same temperature everywhere, but the universe never does that. And so instead, what the universe will have is approximately at a given time, it will have achieved thermal equilibrium. But then as it expands, that the temperature characterizing that thermal equilibrium will change in time. It'll, you know, as the universe expands, the temperature will go down. That's what we're about to derive. But also, when you get to adding perturbations, spatial perturbations, the temperature can vary. The temperature can vary from point to point in space. So this position in space over here can be approximately in thermal equilibrium and not really know yet about a distant area over here that is also in approximate equilibrium but at a slightly different temperature. And so this is like a key physical fact that we'll get to later, that when you look at the cosmic microwave background, you see this effect. You see that in any direction you look, the temperature, it looks almost like an equilibrium distribution of photons is coming at you, but with a slightly different temperature at different points on this guy, because they're coming from different places ahead. Yeah.
The universe, right? This is just like...
That's exactly right. So far, this is just statistical mechanics. That's right. So I'm about to argue that the first... that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So I'm about to say that that as the... So key fact number one is that this can be derived in various ways, but the easiest thing to say, the easiest route to seeing key point number one is just to say that we just arrived here that during the radiation-dominated epoch, when the universe was just a bath of relativistic particles, was dominated by relativistic particles in thermal equilibrium, bouncing around off each other like crazy, rho is proportional to t to the fourth. On the other hand, we showed in the previous lecture that a bath of relativistic particles has rho proportional to a to the minus 4, that rho decreases as the universe expands. And so what we learn from that is that as the universe expands during the radiation-dominated epoch, it gradually cools. With comparing this formula and this formula, you see that t goes down as 1 over a. Okay? And so I should say, so this is another one of these things that this is like actually something that you should remember after this course is done. That as the universe cools, it cools in this simple way as it expands. But let me say I should have said one thing before deriving this, which is, you know, so when can you treat the bath of radiation in the early universe as being in thermal equilibrium? Because, I mean, the universe is expanding, right? You know, an equilibrium system is typically a system that is just sitting there still. You know, it has reached equilibrium. The universe is clearly not doing that. It's expanding, and so things are changing, and, you know, we'll see that all sorts of things change as the universe expands. So what are we doing describing it? What are we doing talking about thermal equilibrium in this context? And so the answer, you know, physically is that let's say that there are certain reactions that are responsible for taking a system that was out of equilibrium and allowing it to relax to equilibrium. If those reactions are taking place with rates that are much larger than the expansion, than the Hubble expansion rate, then many of these reactions occur before the universe has had a chance to expand by a significant amount. If you're in this situation where the reaction rates responsible for establishing equilibrium are much higher than the expansion rate, well, so H, remember what H is. H is d log a dt. Okay, so in other words, it's the time scale at a given moment. H at that moment is telling you what is the time scale you should expect for the universe to go from its current size to E times its current size, right? Is that clear? So for the scale factor to expand from A naught to E times A naught, you know, for it to change by an appreciable order one factor, the time scale associated with that is the instantaneous Hubble rate. Whereas this is the reaction rate. So this is saying tons of reactions are taking place before the universe has had a chance to expand at all. So it's like the gas in this room. You know, it manages to equilibrate over some time scale, and during that time scale, the universe has not done much. And so, you know, there's a perfectly, very approximately well-defined, I mean, it's a very good approximation to talk about thermal equilibrium being established in this room or in a laboratory on Earth, even though the universe is expanding. So the same thing is true of the gas that is equilibrating in the universe, as long as the rates at which it is equilibrating are huge relative to the expansion rate. Okay, and so in that circumstance, the expansion of the universe, you know, you can think of it as like, you know, you learned in a thermodynamics class that if you adiabatically expand a piston, if you take gas in a piston and you expand the piston slowly enough, you don't drive the system at all out of thermal equilibrium. All that happens is that the parameters characterizing that equilibrium adiabatically change with the expansion of the piston. So the same thing is true. This property that T is going down as 1 upon A as the universe expands. The universe is just being a big adiabatically expanding piston in that derivation, okay? But, so the other thing that happens, so we've said that during the radiation-dominated era, the universe is expanding, and as it expands, the temperature is going down. But then, as it goes down, you can have particle species, like let's say the proton or some other species. Let's say the dark matter particle. Maybe there's some dark matter particle hanging around in the early universe. And at what can I erase? Maybe. Huh? That was the best choice. Okay. Initially, the temperature is huge. It's much bigger than the mass of some random massive particle in the early universe. And so that particle is just happily behaving like a photon. It's just part of the bath, man. But then, eventually, T drops as the universe expands, and it gets to the point where it becomes less than or equal to the mass of that particle. And then, suddenly, you get into this regime. Suddenly, the particle is like, whoa, man, something has changed. I'm becoming really rare. Thermal equilibrium wants me to annihilate or go away very fast. And so that particle finds that it's suddenly becoming exponentially rare after the temperature drops below its mass. So the photon is still, you know, it still has all its buddies, but suddenly the chi particle, you know, it looks around and it's like where did all my brothers go? And so then what happens then? What can happen then, a key point about understanding the early universe is that what can happen is that when the temperature drops below the mass of a particle, so that it starts very rapidly to become rare, it can be the case that the reactions necessary to keep that particle in equilibrium also dramatically slow down. So when the particle was in equilibrium originally, those rates were much higher than H, but then suddenly, as it becomes very rare, those reactions catapult as well, and it can no longer stay in equilibrium. So even though naively, this formula would say that as the temperature goes down, that massive particle should become exponentially rare, maybe that can only go on for a finite time until it falls out of equilibrium and this formula no longer applies. And so just to foreshadow what will be in a coming lecture, you know, one of the leading proposed explanations for what the dark matter in the universe today is that it was some massive particle chi in the early universe, and as the temperature dropped below the mass of that particle began, you know, thermal equilibrium wanted to make that particle become very rare. But let's say that the only reaction by which it can become rare, the key reaction for maintaining thermal equilibrium is annihilation. So, So the only way you can get rid of a chi particle, which is what thermal equilibrium wants you to do, the only way you can do it is by a chi particle annihilating with its antiparticle to two photons, let's say. But you reach a point where the reaction rate drops, the rate of this reaction drops. At some moment, the reaction rate becomes equal to H. And then for all time after that, it becomes much smaller than H. So physically, you know, there reaches a point where there are so few chi particles and so few chi bars that a chi will never, in the rest of the age of the universe, find another chi bar to annihilate with. He just sees photons and other abundant particles, and there's just no chi bar to be found. So after that moment, even though this process reaction is allowed in principle, it never happens again. And so in practice, what happens after that moment is that this formula fails, and instead, the number of chi and chi bars is just conserved. And so instead, the number density of chi and chi bars falls like a conserved quantity does. We said that it will fall as 1 upon a cubed, which is much slower than exponentially. And so the thing that we will discuss is that the nice feature about this explanation is that if you plug in sort of the first numbers that you might plug in from particle physics into this scenario, you find that the abundance, so these guys just hang around to today, and if you calculate how much of them is hanging around today, the first estimate you do according to this scenario gives you an abundance which is about equal to the observed dark matter abundance today. Okay, so that goes under the title of the so-called WIMP miracle, which will be the subject of part of a future lecture. Okay, but so that's one of the key reasons that people that this is one of the favored scenarios.
Does that explanation have anything to do with the fact that we can't see dark matter?
So it turns out so this is another question I'm gonna postpone. But yeah, so I said when you plug in the first numbers you can think of from particle physics. So, you know, one of the things that you might have thought was that so I plugged in a weak cross section here. That's a weak scale cross section. A cross section that is the natural cross section characteristic of the weak interactions, and then everything works. If instead I had used the electromagnetic interactions, I'd imagined it was maybe an electromagnetically charged particle that could annihilate with its electromagnetically charged antiparticle, or a strongly interacting particle, then both of those options, you know, interacts via the strong force. Both of those options are ruled out by the fact that you would be able to see them too easily, whereas we don't, in various ways, we don't see dark matter the weak scale cross section that produces this is sufficiently weak that it's consistent with the fact that you don't see them. They're hard to see for the same reason that neutrinos are hard to see, because you can only interact with them via weak interactions. Let's see. So did I say that? So that process is called freeze-out. That's a good term to learn. More generally, this thing where a particle species thermal equilibrium wants it to become extremely rare, but then it eventually becomes so rare that it can't maintain thermal equilibrium, that's called decoupling. Or just in general, when a species, for one reason or another, when the reaction rates responsible for maintaining its thermal equilibrium fail to be larger than H, the species decouples from the rest of the thermal bath of particles. I've tried to condense Big Bang nucleosynthesis into its 15-minute essence, which I'm hoping is going to blow your mind. Okay, I'm going to erase all of this. Okay, so a man goes to the KGB and he says, you know, I would like to report that my parrot has disappeared. And the KGB says, you know, that's a criminal matter, sir. You know, you should go tell the police. You know, we're not your guys. And he says, yes, but I am just coming to report that I vehemently disagree with my parrot. Was that joke not funny or just didn't make any sense?
I think you have to know a little bit of a life on your
sort of human. Well, I leave even with no knowledge of history, I leave that joke to stand on its own up to the interpretation of the interpretation of the list. Okay, that was the worst. That joke bombed more than any previous joke bombed. That's significantly below what any other joke has achieved. Did you have a question?
Yeah. If you find RAM particles at high energy, is that?
If you, what? Yeah.
So are you more likely to find RAM particles at high energy, or any sufficiently different to what we're currently at?
Do you mean very massive particles that you don't see in the universe today were much more common in the early universe? Is that what you mean? When the energy scales were higher?
I'm wondering, if a particle is sufficiently out of thermal equilibrium, it's going to be an energy that scales.
Oh, yes. That's right. That's right. So somehow thermal equilibrium is associated with this thing called the Planck distribution. So there's some if you plot the number of particles as a function of their energy at some temperature T, then there's that distribution is peaked at an energy which is about equal to T. And so you expect most of the part, if the system is in thermal equilibrium, most of the particles you see will have an energy that's about equal to T, with relatively few below. Here you have this is dying like a power law, but above you see exponentially few. This is an exponential cutoff. But in various different circumstances in astrophysics and cosmology, you will often see a system where part of it is in or approximately in thermal equilibrium, but then you see many more particles over out at this high energy range than you would expect based on thermal considerations. And yes, you have to. So that's telling you that whatever produced these particles, it was some out of equilibrium process. That either some process where these particles were once in equilibrium and then fell out of equilibrium, maybe in the cosmological context. Or in the astrophysical context, just some mechanism that never was associated with thermal equilibrium, with the thermal bath over here produced those particles. That sort of thing does show up in various ways. So first, let me just say, what's the idea of Big Bang nucleosynthesis? So the universe. So you have the periodic table. Okay? You have some periodic table. I don't know. It has bits and pieces. And if you look out in the universe, what you see is 75% of the mass in the universe is hydrogen, the first element in the periodic table. The next 25% is helium, the second element in the periodic table. And then there are trace amounts of most of the other elements. And those trace amounts are very important. They're largely what you are constituted of, and they're responsible for life on Earth, and they're important in various ways. I don't know if that's, if life on Earth wasn't convincing enough for you. Can you quantitatively understand? Where did those elements come from? When and where were they produced? Can you quantitatively understand their abundances? And so the mid-20th century was sort of the heyday of nuclear physics, where people didn't know how to do quantum field theory yet. Quantum field theory was a complete mess. You couldn't stand on sure footing with any calculation. It was magic, basically, and trickery, and like getting drowning. But there were a handful of extremely clever people who nevertheless managed to an amazing degree answer those questions, quantitatively account for the various abundances of the various elements. So as far as I'm aware, the main people were, there was Hans Bethe, Willy Fowler, I think maybe I even wrote, yeah. So, oh yeah, Fermi, and Gamow, and Hoyle. So, these were some sort of awesome tricksters, who knew, to some inexplicably, who knew this lost art of nuclear physics. But anyway, so they managed to explain that most of the elements in the periodic table up to the element iron, which is somewhere, can be produced by nuclear fusion processes occurring thermally in the centers of stars. So our sun is a so-called main sequence star. So it has hydrogen in its center, which is being crushed to such high temperatures and densities that it's fusing into helium, and that's releasing energy that's letting the sun shine. But more massive stars start off by doing that, but then when they exhaust their hydrogen fuel, they then can move on to another phase where they take all the helium they produced and begin crunching the helium together to form carbon, and this cycle can go on, and they can form higher and higher elements this way, up to iron. Iron is the element in the periodic table that has the lowest binding energy per nucleon, so thermally, by a sort of process in thermal equilibrium, you won't get beyond iron that way. But then they were able to understand in remarkable detail that many of those same elements, but also the elements beyond iron, could be produced in the shock wave that is sent out into space as a massive star explodes as it goes supernova. And so this is so uranium and plutonium, for example, that are used in nuclear reactors and nuclear weapons are produced in that way. But this guy Gamow was the one who realized that if you looked at just the first few elements in the periodic table, the hydrogen, the helium, lithium, and beryllium, elements 1, 2, 3, and 4, that those could not be explained in this way. So in particular, there was way too much helium. 25% of the mass in the universe is in helium, and that's way too much to explain by burning in the centers of stars. So one way to say that is that if you take all the hydrogen in the universe and you convert 25% of its mass into helium, every four hydrogens that you convert into helium emit a lot of energy. They emit 28 MeV or something like that. That's a lot of energy. So if that is all emitted as starlight from stars, that's much more starlight than as far as we can tell has ever been emitted by all the stars in the universe. So, So it was this guy Gamow, this awesome guy, who realized that you could, that instead, that the probable explanation was that the helium was produced in the first few seconds or minutes after the Big Bang. And so to see that you can produce that 25% of helium in the Big Bang you can do it by a simple back of the envelope calculation. Let me start by giving some context with a few energy scales here. Okay, so the Planck scale, the scale that that quantum gravity is supposed to kick in, that's up at 10 to the 19 GeV. Okay, that's about as high. That's about as high as is safe for you to go. I don't recommend boosting any of your particles to higher than that energy. It gets crazy. That's a very high energy. So then, about three orders of magnitude below that, there's this other very high energy, the gut scale. So this is the characteristic energy scale for grand unified theories, grand unified theory, which are theories that unify the electroweak and the strong force with each other, but not with gravity. Okay, these were these things discovered in the 1970s. So that's also a very high energy scale, and that also is, depending on who you ask, the expected upper limit or the expected size of the energy scale during inflation. So we'll get to that. But then beyond that, if you go down another 13 orders of magnitude to 10 to the 3 GeV, you know, that's what the LHC is going to be looking at, or is looking at. 10 to the 2 GeV, so let's say, so this is 1 TeV. Let's say 1 TeV is the LHC. 1 GeV, that's like the mass of the proton, the mass of the neutron. Again, 100 GeV is like the mass of the weak boson, or the weak bosons, the W and the Z bosons. And then you go down by another, a TeV, that means 10 to the 12. So this is, there's a factor of 1,000 down to 1 GeV, which means 10 to the 9 EV. And then another factor of 1,000 is 1 MeV. This is the scale at which Big Bang nucleosynthesis is going to take place. So important things associated with this scale. So this is about the temperature of the universe when Gamow realized the helium was synthesized. And so this is about equal to the proton, the difference in energies between the proton and neutron almost have the same mass, but the difference in their mass is about 1 MeV. And then right below 1 MeV at half an MeV, that's the mass of the electron. Okay, so let's say, for example, you look back in the universe when the temperature was 10 GeV or something like that. So there, that's well above the mass of the proton and the neutron, so protons and antiprotons and neutrons and antineutrons were still relativistic particles. They were in happy thermal equilibrium. They had about the same abundance as the photons. But then the universe expanded, the temperature dropped to 1 GeV. Suddenly, they became non-relativistic. They began to annihilate like crazy. So protons and antiprotons annihilated until all the antiprotons were gone. Neutrons and antineutrons annihilated until all the antineutrons were gone. And then, for some reason that is still not understood, after all of the antineutrons and antiprotons were erased by annihilation, there was still a little bit of proton and neutron left over. So there were some protons and some neutrons left over, but only a tiny fraction, only about 1/1 billionth of the number of protons and neutrons that were there before annihilation. So since then, we've been left with protons and neutrons, but instead of, even though they started out with about the same abundance as the photons, now there's only about, you know, one proton or neutron for every billion photons. So one way you know it is from one way we'll see is that one of the most precise. So the first thing is you can count up how much matter there is in the universe today that's made of baryons and photons. You can basically look out at all take a census of all the stars and gas that you can see through telescopes, and divide that by the number. So you know, take that mass, divide it by the nucleon mass to find the number of nucleons today. Divide that by the number of photons in the cosmic microwave background, and that that is approximately this number. Ever since then, the number of nucleons has been conserved. The total number of nucleons has been conserved. That's by conservation of baryon number. The number of photons has almost been conserved since then. Very, very nearly been conserved since then. So the ratio that you observe today is almost equal to the ratio that it was at that early time. But then also, Big Bang nucleosynthesis gives a measurement of that number. That turns out to be the one free parameter you have to play with in the Big Bang nucleosynthesis calculation. And you tune it until all of the predicted light elements match their observed ratios, and you get a measurement of this ratio that way. So that used to be the most precise measurement. And then now it turns out that the cosmic microwave background gives an even more precise measurement of that same ratio. So it turns out to be about 10 to the minus 9. And that's a key number that remains to be explained in cosmology. That will be the subject of a future lecture on the topic of baryogenesis and leptogenesis and the matter-antimatter asymmetry. That's all about explaining where did this number come from. I'm trying to stick to the not keeping you late. So even though I'm really excited about this, why don't we continue next time? I know that was a lot of build up to just not finish, but I'm worried it's going to take like another 15 minutes to do it right. That's just wrong. All that build up and then to just peter out. But at the beginning of next lecture, I will get to the punchline here rather than going late.